Good evening. Lots of sunshine today. So welcome, everyone. You here before? No. You have not. A special welcome to you. How did you hear about us?
Meetup.org.
Really?
Yeah.
You're the first one to come from Meetup, and it's been on for a year. I'm so glad. So do introductions around.
Wendy, Judy, Leslie,
Daniel.
I'm with the street.
Yeah.
Ellie.
And Angie. So Daniel, we're studying the Four Noble Truths using this book. And we've come to the, I guess, the wind-up of the first noble truth. We talked about the three types of suffering a little bit last time. Suffering of suffering, when we break a leg or get old, the conditional suffering because everything is changing, and then the enormity of the universal suffering, that everything is constantly in some kind of decay and falling apart, as well as coming back together again. So whether it's stars exploding or galaxies crashing into each other, or magma coming gushing out of the earth itself, those kinds of things. So then we come to what creates the suffering. And there are many ways of describing it, many ways of talking about it, but the essential thing that Buddha discovered was how connected everything was to our essential ignorance about how things really are. Based on ignorance, based on our not understanding how it is, so the it, meaning our life, our breath, our unfolding as we go through time, the whole thing, when you really stop to think about it, is very, very mysterious. And Buddha saw that it was connected to how our body operates, that it's all a body information and unfolding through how we take things into us as knowing. We could call it knowing, a sort of visceral knowing. We start with a visceral knowing, and then based on that we get excited about something that we see or we smell, and we make connections with it, and then we create a story, and then the story creates more story, and we make a story out of the story of the story, and then our life begins to unfold in a way that is slightly out of control, as our mind is spinning, and it spins until it spins all the way down again. And whether it's, you know, in the convention, it ends with old age and death. Boom, it's over. And then in the original notion, then there's a rebirth of ignorance, and you start all over again. And it goes on and on. And only human birth can get off of it. If you're born as an animal, if you're born as a warrior, you're born in the hell realm, you just can't get out of it. It's too overwhelming. This is extremely metaphorical, I think, for most of us, though I'm sure there are people who take it literally. but in my mind, it's psychologically describes in a very fine way how our mind is working and how stuck we are in our ignorance. That once we misunderstand ourselves, that we begin to try to hold on to the things that we think will make that self viable and valuable and real. And we try to get rid of the stuff that we think doesn't fit so well. And we start orchestrating and rewriting and revamping our whole situation in ways that are extremely dreamlike. It's just a dream. So this whole notion of ignorance is essential to understanding that suffering becomes suffering because we are ignoring the truth of our life. So from this, then Buddha said that because we are creating, clinging to this self, that there's a way to stop. We don't have to do it, which is because we're human and we're allowed to stop. We don't have to go spinning out all the way to the end and then start all over again. We tend not to stop. People are told, when I tell people I sit meditation, they say, oh, I couldn't do that. Oh, I'm too busy. My mind is going all the time. I couldn't stop. And yet, stopping is the trick. Stopping is the thing. And once you stop, you have to see how your mind is working. You can't pretend, because you have to look at it. It's right there. There's nothing else. You're kind of stuck with your own silly thoughts and all those stories that we tell and get so caught by. It's a process, I think, that goes on our whole life. There is no one way to stop and cut it off forever. Although part of the teaching is that you can burn it out. But then the fourth noble truth is that actually you're not a burnt out person. You just have a good job and you're not doing any harm to people. And you're living a life of meditation. And you're keeping the view that is clear and honest. So it actually offers a path as the fourth truth that keeps us very much in the world and living and having to stop over and over again in order to make sense of our life. Dalai Lama sits every day. Been doing it for 81 years now. So there's no magic button to push. There's no way that it's going to make us perfect people. But it will give us a view of what this life is. the incredible, complex, and really awesome life of us. We call it myself, but myself includes everybody and everything. So Dalai Lama talks about a lot about ignorance, and Koban always did too. So I brought you some comments that Koban made about ignorance, because his way of saying it is so interesting. The word is avidya. Avidya means clarity, and the a means no clarity. So it means, as Koban says, we're in the dark. It's being in the dark, so dark you can't see anything, so dark that if you think you need a hand for something, you can't find your hand. You don't even know you've got it. That's how deep our ignorance can be. And we begin longing for seeing something. In Chinese, it's mu miao. Mu is no. It's the negative. And miao means sun and moon, or no light. No light. We just chanted that. Mu mu miao. No ignorance. Mu mu miao. Right down there in about three quarters of the way down. Koban says it means we don't know what we are. It's like a shellfish thinking that the inside of his shell is the world. That's very cool. It's all you can see. So the objective self, the thing self of us that we try to understand, does not exist. So we're, as long as we're basing ourselves on the idea that there's some permanent person here who is always the same, never changes, and will never die, which we all believe because it's so hard to think that you might not be here, that all of that is avidya. It's our ignorance at work, or our lack of wisdom. Koban said the conceptual knowledge-based self, the thought self, is nothing but a game of made-up self-consciousness, an image of ignorance, so to speak. Life has to be free and lived instead of being known. I get caught by this all the time. I just want to see what my life is like, and I want to know it. I've been rescuing all the poems I ever wrote and putting them all in the computer. And it looks like a whole self. It's shocking, really. It's all the different eras that I ever lived through, all the things I liked and didn't like and wanted and didn't get, and it's just amazing. And then I get caught by thinking of, oh, that person. But it really wasn't a person, it was a process, a long, long process, which is still. But you really can't say it's me, because it's 100,000,000,000,000,000,000 me's. You can't begin to understand it. You can look at little bits and pieces of it, but your whole life is like that. It's all those amazing things that happen. But they go on happening. You never can stay. However much you want to stay, you cannot stay. It's very sad, really, in a lot of ways. It's pretty sad. So he reminds that it's based in Buddha's teaching, it's ignorance is based on the five desires, which are the five hindrances, the basic things that get in the way. And that is our greed for food, sleep, sex, shelter, and being known by others. And this is a really important point, because every single one of those is a survival thing. Every one of them is something we will die without. We cannot stop eating. We can't stop any of those. It's how we're made. So the trick is not to be obsessed with any of them. And as we all know, we live in a world that is in some ways so fortunate that we can exercise these hindrances, these five desires, and make bigger and bigger houses, have fancier and fancier food, have more and more extraordinary stuff, have better of everything, bigger and better. And we're always asking each other how much and how many. It's a kind of stuck place. And once it's seen, you don't have to do it anymore. That's so cool. Trying to see clearly means we don't have to do that. We can choose. And so choosing is a really essential part of this whole process as well. We are not automatic. We're not on automatic completely. A lot of us is. Our breathing, our hearts, our bellies, our bodies mostly are on automatic, but we have autonomy and we can decide how to live. And that was Buddha's whole point. We can decide. So in his story under the tree, when he was sitting, he kept meeting Mara, who kept saying, "Oh, you can have all this stuff. I'll give you all the money you ever could possibly want." And Buddha would say, "I see you, Mara. I see what you're doing." And Mara says, "Oh, he sees me." And he runs away. So he was offered power over the whole world. He saw Mara. He saw it. Said that religions arise on the awareness of ignorance. Well, that was very interesting. That once we see it, we think, "Oh, what is this? how shall we live? And we begin to see how hard it is to live if we don't understand it. How very painful and difficult it is without this basic understanding of our ignorance. Dalai Lama talks a lot about cause. The causal relationship between ignorance and how we act. It's a kind of complicated and Vajrayana view of how this all works. If you're interested, it's right here under the truth of suffering. And then he goes on to talk about consciousness. About how discursive thoughts and feelings occur within the mind. And really, in a sense, that's all we are, besides our digestion and various things else. It's our feelings and our thinking that defines us in a way. He said, there is no doubt that our consciousness and all our experiences are contingent upon our body. So the human mind and the human body are in some sense inextricable. And then he goes on to say that maybe there's a little extra going on that we can actually have some power in our mind that they haven't discovered in science yet. He's very, very curious about the physical base of the brain and how the brain is working. Because actually, and I've been reading a lot about this consciousness business that is studied by a lot of people now, and nobody agrees on what it is. Nobody can put their finger on it in the brain. Can't quite define it even. Buddha said it just means being awake. I think that's a great definition. That's enough. It's not being sound asleep. Dalai Lama says, most of our conscious mind consists either of states related with objects that we've experienced in the past. Past experiences inform our present consciousness, memory. Or it consists of some kind of feeling or sensation. As a result, it's very difficult for us to glimpse the actual nature of consciousness, which is, in this Vajrayana terms, the sheer state of knowing or the luminosity of mind, which is another way of saying light. It's the darkness of ignorance lighted up. When you're able to clear away thoughts of the past and the future, slowly you begin to get a sense of the space between the two. The space between past and future, where's that? Right here. You learn to abide in the present moment. In that space, you begin to glimpse what we call emptiness. And if you can remain in that emptiness for longer and longer periods of time, then gradually the nature of consciousness itself, which is the sheer luminosity and natural awareness of mind, will slowly dawn in you. So So you could say that we're sitting for the dawn. So are there questions? Mimi?
Thank you so much for the talk. I often wonder, what's the purpose of sitting zazen and studying zen?
I think if we try to figure out what the purpose is, we get all mixed up. I think we just do it as a natural human activity. It's a kind of necessary action. Once you find out about it, you kind of tend to want to do it some more. I don't think we can explain it much more than that, really. Or if we do, we get all mixed up. What do you think?
Well, because I'm new to this group, and I would like to have better understanding of what we are doing here, and that's why I asked that question.
I see.
And also, I'd like to ask you another question, if you don't mind. We bow to the cushion, and relatively speaking, cushion. Just a thing we sit on, and it doesn't weigh much value. And yet, we bow to the cushion before zazen, after zazen, and actually we hold it to hands. So my question is, why do we need to do so?
That's a very good question. It's to recognize it too as ourself. Which means our self is huge and is not our self at all. It is all the many things that are supporting everything. We cannot live all alone. We think so. We think we're just this is me. I'm all by myself. And I'm in my little house and nobody's around and but actually, everything is holding us. Everything. The air, the molecules in the air, the ground, the walls and the floors, the grass and the trees, the sofas, the chairs. And so, if you really think about it that way, how much we need support, how desperately, and we're just little animals, just these little frail things. We need all the support we can get. So it's just saying, thank you. Thank you very much. Just a gesture of gratitude. That's all.
Thank you very much.
Let me have a partial answer to your question also. Alan Watts, I read the book on something about Zen, the way of Zen or something like that. He's talking about everybody has a talent, a special facility. Like some people are good at music, some people are good at sports. So there are some people who have within them the potential to realize who they really are. And they don't know why they've got this, it's just genetics, if you will. It's just there. But they just don't feel right until they're sitting.
Yes.
For me, it's the same thing. I knew there was something missing, but I didn't know what until I started looking at things and reading about Zen and doing things like that. All of a sudden, things started making sense. I came to a Zen sit, I sat for one period and said, oh.
I get it.
That's it, does it? Scratch that itch. I've been scratching it ever since. It feels good. But I still don't know why I do it.
Yes.
Except that it feels good.
Yes.
So that's all I got.
Yeah. Good answer. Leslie?
So, a couple of things. This, I've been doing kind of a swimming practice for a while, a little sporadically, but more regularly. So, I do the loving kindness meditation as I'm swimming.
Nice.
As best I can.
Mm-hmm.
And it has this idea of what's between the past and the future. When I'm swimming, I can more easily notice when I'm not right here, because when you're in the water, it's so sensing, you know, like you feel it. I feel it on myself.
Yeah.
And yet, as I'm doing the loving kindness meditation, it doesn't take anything. I get to see that place where I wander, where I start to go off. It's just amazing to me how little it takes to start a story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little easier there than it is. Here, I don't know why I'm pushing, but it's a similar discipline.
It's a different kind of samadhi, but it's a samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And in walking meditation, one of the instructions that I had was to see if you could catch yourself. You could observe the moment, observe the moment before you lifted your foot. So when the intention to lift your foot comes, if you could mark that place, because that's as close to the present as one might be able to get. And that's
oh, that's, I haven't heard that, but that's nice. Yeah, thank you. Well, it's 8 o'clock. So, I hope we can all stay cool as possible. I have a cat who has a lot of fur. And she loves to be outside in the sun all day long on days like this. So she's my teacher. If she can do it, one can do it.
So Manji's going to be giving the Dharma talk at Jikoji this Sunday.
Yes.
11:40.
Zazen starts at 10:30.
10 o'clock, actually.
10 o'clock? Oh, I'm glad. Glad to know that. I'll try to be there. yes, 10 o'clock. Two sits, a break, and then a talk. And it will be on the Fourth Noble Truth. So it's a carry on with the whole subject. Be good.
So on this Thursday till Sunday, I invited some friends, and those friends invited some friends of our family to come sit. And so there will be a group of about 12 of us. So during any of those days, if you'd like to come up or join us for a meal, Amrita Shri will be Tenzo, and we'll be eating Oryoki style. So that'll be really helpful, actually, to have some people around who know how to do that. So, of course, you're invited to join if you would like to. that just let us know. We're all very new.
Is there an email address to contact?
My email address. I sent an email about this to the Floating Zen No group. I'm happy to send another one just to reiterate the information. And like Angie said, so because it's a lot of people who are new to this tradition, we thought it'd be nice to go back to the beginning and study the Four Noble Truths. And so we'll conclude with the Fourth Noble Truth, which is when Angie comes to speak on Sunday.
But you have other speakers speaking about the others,
That's right. Three. Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. On Saturday, we have Doug, who lives at Jikoji. On Friday, that's when Joe will start. We'll talk. Who is also there?
Okay. I have a little announcement.
Sure.
I brought some fruit, some nectarines from my tree. So everybody, I hope there's enough for everybody. But please take one.
Oh, thank you, Leslie. Okay, we'll have a 1-minute sit.